This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's been law for about 2 years, but getting medical marijuana to become a reality in Connecticut has faced a number of hurdles. Licensing producers and dispensaries, signing up patients and doctors, they've all been a bit of a challenge. Today, Where We Live, we'll get an update and answer your questions with the man tasked with administering this program. We'll also check in with neighboring states, Massachusetts and New York. Each are in the process of enacting their own medical marijuana systems, and they're facing some of their own challenges. We'll find out how they're doing, and we'll also look at how legalization efforts are going in western states like Colorado and Washington. Those states are having their own series of challenges after broadening their marijuana laws to include recreational as well as medical usage. There is a lot to talk about, and I'm sure you've got questions. Join the conversation at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. What are some of your questions about our new medical marijuana law and how it's going to roll out later this summer? You can always comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I'd like to welcome back to the studio William Rubenstein, who is commissioner of the State Department of Consumer Protection. They oversee this program, and it's just a part of what the department does, but it's been an awful lot of the job over the course of the last couple of years. Bill Rubenstein, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here, John.
Maybe you could just go over the basics again. What is this going to look like once it's fully implemented in Connecticut?
Well, we've been working on this project for 2 years. We're starting essentially an industry from scratch. And the way Connecticut's approached medical marijuana is to treat it like any other controlled pharmaceutical substance. That is a strong role for physicians in determining which patients should have access to the product, treating the growers and producers like pharmaceutical manufacturers and having the product dispensed by licensed pharmacists. So we've been setting up the exact system to do that. Last time I think I was here, we were in the process of going through applications to see who was going to be licensed as producers and dispensers. So since then, we've licensed 4 producers. We've licensed 6 dispensary facilities. The producers have been busy for the past 4 or 5 months building out state-of-the-art pharmaceutical manufacturing facilities. They are just about ready to have their first product come off the shelf. We expect product to be in the dispensaries by the end of the summer. Small number of producers at first, and then ultimately all the producers over the course of the fall with a full range of products.
I think the first thing, and we spent some time on this during our last visit and catch up on this, is let's understand a little bit better the medical conditions that this will be applied to. There's a very strict list of medical conditions, and we already got a tweet from Neil. He says, decriminalization and medical use are good first steps. Connecticut's strict regulations won't allow people with tummy aches, he put that in quote, to get it as in California. I'm sure we can get back into some of the California issues with medical marijuana use. Maybe you can explain the medical conditions that doctors can sign off on.
So the legislature set out 11 specific debilitating conditions that doctors can certify patients as qualifying for medical marijuana. They include things like cancer, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, HIV/AIDS, post-traumatic stress syndrome, Crohn's disease, wasting syndrome. There's 11 of them, but they're very specific, and it's only for those specific conditions that doctors are able to certify patients for use. There is a process to increase that list, either by legislative action, or we have a board of physicians who hears petitions from the public to add conditions. There's a hearing on that. Ultimately, a regulation would be provided. So there's a process to add debilitating conditions, but at the moment there are 11 very specific conditions.
Could any primary care physician prescribe for one of these conditions, or do doctors themselves have to be licensed to prescribe?
No, all medical doctors in the state of Connecticut are able to certify. It's not a prescription. They certify the patient as having one of the conditions after they've done a medically reasonable assessment, that they've discussed the pros and cons with the patient, that the they believe in a professional judgment that this medicine would be beneficial for the patient. After they certify all those things, patients can register with the Department of Consumer Protection to be on our list of qualified patients.
So essentially that means that certification is in lieu of a prescription. You wouldn't have to get a prescription every time that you would want to, I suppose, get some product.
The certification is good for a year, although a physician can shorten that time period, and so it's largely dependent on the physician as a gatekeeper, but the physician must recertify every year at least.
We're answering some questions with William Rubenstein. He's commissioner of the Department of Consumer Protection. They're rolling out the state's medical marijuana program later on this summer. It's been 2 years in the making. Other states like New York and Massachusetts are going about this in different ways, and we'll be finding out how our neighboring states are tackling this. We'd like to hear from you with your questions about our medical marijuana program, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Previously, before this became something that you could certify or prescribe, doctors weren't able to prescribe this to patients. How has that been going, getting physicians up to speed on how to use this as a potential way to cure some of these problems?
Well, it's a learning process for a lot of physicians, for them to get comfortable with the science, comfortable with when their patients might benefit from the use of medical marijuana. We currently have about 100 physicians who have certified patients. That's not a large number compared to the number of physicians, but it's an increase over time for us. So as physicians learn more about the science, they step into the program more and more.
And we're going to be talking about some of the economics of this and getting the producers and the dispensers up and running in just a moment. But let's talk about if there's a supply and a demand question. Let's talk about the demand piece of this first. Last time we were here, we talked about maybe only a handful of people really signing on to the program. It was brand new. It was something that people didn't understand very well. You say about 100 doctors have certified patients. It doesn't sound like we've signed up a whole lot of people to be taking advantage of this program yet.
Well, I don't know what it is in relative terms. I can tell you we have about 2,000 qualified registered patients in our program. We started registering patients in October 2012. We have not had an available source of supply even yet. That won't come until later in the summer. So there's 2,000 people who have a fairly significant pent-up demand. That is that they have a medical need for this product and their physicians think it's appropriate for them. We think that once a product is actually available so that people aren't going to the streets to buy product, that physicians will feel more comfortable with the product and more patients will consider it as one of the alternatives for their treatment.
Do you have some sort of a benchmark set in your mind as to how many patients are going to sign up, how many patients you'd like to sign up? Obviously, you don't want people with debilitating conditions, but there are a certain number of thousands of people who may suffer from one of these 11 things that are on the list. Do you have a target benchmark in your mind?
You know, we really don't. This is really driven by patient need and physician comfort. We can look at other states in terms of what percentage of the population qualify, but it's hard to extrapolate from that because we have a very limited list of conditions in comparison to other states. You know, just plain chronic pain is not a sufficient condition. It has to be connected with one of the specific 11 debilitating conditions. So it's really hard to make that judgment. What we try to do is size the program to the patient base, so a number of producers that's capable of having a steady stream of supply to the number of patients we have, a number of dispensaries that economically can serve those patients, but not to have much more than that.
Obviously, as you said, not apples-to-apples comparisons necessarily because there are different laws in different states, but could you just give us a sampling of what other states are finding as far as percentage of people who are signing up for a program?
You know, I think states that have very broad conditions may have as many as 1% or more of the population that signs up.
So 1% of the population in Connecticut would be something like 30,000 people or so?
Right, but you know that those are in states that have broader conditions attached.
We're going to get to some phone calls right now at 860-275-7266. But just quickly, we went through this obviously with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, as it's known in Connecticut and elsewhere. There were sort of targets for how many people they wanted to sign up, so as to make the economics work. If, let's say, we don't get enough people signing up for this and we have a very expensive process of making this stuff, do we end up having economics that don't work for our marijuana program?
We actually went the other way. We looked at what our population base actually was and decided to license a number of producers, a number of dispensers that could economically serve that population base with a degree of expansion capability so our producers can scale up as demand scales up, but they can be economically viable at the current level. And if the patient population increases substantially, we'll add producers and dispensers as needed.
Let's go to the phones if you have questions for William Rubenstein, who heads the Department of Consumer Protection and this medical marijuana program. Obviously, they've got other things on their plate, but this has been a big undertaking for the Consumer Protections Department. Derek is calling from Windsor. Hey there, Derek. Go ahead.
Yeah, John, how are you? It's Windsor, not South Windsor. Windsor.
Absolutely. So it's good to hear from
right.
you.
All right. As usual, let me commend you on your good program. But first thing I want to clear up, John, is that marijuana is not a drugs. And the people that's in authority, they know that. I think they only associated with the name drugs to put a bad deal on it. That's the first thing. The second thing, I don't believe in this medical marijuana thing. I think it's just another wool over the eye thing kind of deal to legalize marijuana throughout the United States. And mark my word, John, it's going to happen. I've been saying this for a long, 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 long time. It's going to illegalize in America. And the third thing is that how is this going to affect other countries that's sending marijuana into America?
So three very good questions. Derek, thank you very much, as always, for your phone call. He was asking about other countries that sell marijuana into the United States right now. Do we know what getting a legal marketplace for medical marijuana in Connecticut is going to do to what we'll call the black market, the street market right now?
Well, you know, it's really hard to know exactly what the what the black market is. You know, we're dealing with a fairly small number of patients. We expect those patients, to the extent that they're looking to the black market right now for their medicine, will shift away from the black market and lower the demand on the black market, because we're going to offer them a product that is pharmaceutical grade, that's laboratory tested, labeled with active ingredient, and made under strict pharmaceutical guidances. So I don't know, you know, so our program will actually move demand away from the street into our program.
I've got to assume that you've done some what we'll call market research on the street drug right now. I mean, you probably know a little bit something about what the black market in Connecticut is like.
Well, we know from anecdotally what street price is for marijuana, and that serves in some sense as a cap for the price of marijuana through our dispensaries, because that is a competitive effect. But we expect our producers ultimately to be producing efficiently to actually have lower costs than the black market, and therefore competitive forces should force prices down.
We're going to actually shelve Derek's other point until later on in the program and talk about whether or not this might mean, as it has in other Western states, whether or not this might be a move toward full legalization for recreational use. Thanks again, Derek, for the phone call. Annette is calling from West Hartford. Hello there. Go ahead. Hi there, Annette. Are you there?
Oh, yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
I sure can. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I'm a physician, actually, and I work. My work is hospital-based, and I have a lot of patients who I think would really benefit from it. Of course, we cannot, I'm told, prescribe it in the hospital, and the hospital wouldn't be able to dispense it anyway. But on discharge from the hospital, I've tried to certify patients to be able to take it. I had a cancer patient who was wasting away, and she was perfect for it and willing to do it. But I couldn't certify her because I'm not her primary caregiver, and her primary caregiver was not yet comfortable with it. Neither were her cancer doctors. I spoke with both her cancer doctors and her primary care physician. They were not comfortable with it. I was willing to certify her, but after going through the process on the website, I was told I couldn't do it because I wasn't her primary caregiver, and my question was whether that was going to change.
Great questions. Thank you very much for your phone call.
You know, it's not a question of whether or not you're the primary caregiver. That is any medical doctor is capable of certifying. But it has to do with whether or not you can make the proper certifications that the patient has been diagnosed, whether you accept the diagnosis maybe of others, that you've done a medically reasonable assessment of the patient, that you've discussed the pros and cons with the patient. So I think if you look carefully at what the certification questions are, to the extent that you're willing to do the appropriate assessment and review the medical files of the patient, you should be able to make the appropriate certifications.
But I think what she brings up, and I think it's a fantastic question, because it brings up two sides, I suppose, of the same coin. One side of this coin is a doctor who believes that a patient would benefit but believes that the primary care physician or other doctors wouldn't want to actually certify. And then they, I think there's a flip side of it, something that I think we're always concerned about is doctor shopping. Someone who actually is looking for a doctor who will certify, who maybe isn't their primary care physician, just someone who will give them the certification.
Look, in our entire medical experience, we interact with our physicians. Our physicians give us certain advice. We don't like their advice, so we think that better treatment is a way to go. And we might seek out a different doctor to talk about the pros and cons of a better treatment, get a second opinion, go see another doctor. You know, it's the same process that we might go through for any therapeutic treatment that our particular physician doesn't think is appropriate. You as a patient think it might be, and you seek out a different opinion from another qualified physician. So you know, patients need to advocate for themselves for their own treatment with physicians and find physicians who they can connect with and come to an understanding what their appropriate treatment should be.
But just to that end, just so that I understand, what safeguards are in place? Because I think what the doctor was talking about is something very different than this. But what safeguards are in place for someone who is just looking to get certified and is looking for a doctor who will certify them?
So that problem that you call doctor shopping is not a different problem than we have with all prescription drugs.
Absolutely.
It's the same exact problem for people who shop around for doctors who might prescribe OxyContin or Adderall or Ritalin.
And I'll just stop you and say, and that's become a really big problem in our area and across the country. And so in this new world, it seems like appropriate to put some safeguards in place.
Right. Yeah. So it's really not a new world is the point that I'm making. It's the same problem. So we use the same tools. Our drug control agents oversee this industry the way that we oversee all of our controlled pharmaceutical substances. All medical marijuana has to get that's sold has to get reported into our prescription monitoring program, just like all other controlled pharmaceutical substances. So we have ways of tracking, whether or not patients are actually shopping, doctor shopping. There's a whole series of protocols that us and along with law enforcement can deal with the doctor shopping issue, but it's not any different problem for medical marijuana, and we don't see it as a medical marijuana problem. It's a prescription drug abuse problem, and we deal with it that way.
Let's get to a few more phone calls before our break here. Arnie is calling from Haddam. Hello, Arnie. Arnie, are you there? No, Arnie, but Colin, I'll bet, is also there. Colin is from Haddam. Let's see if we can find Colin. Hello, Colin. Colin, are you there? We're seeing people drop off the line, so that means more time for you to call at 860-275-7266. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking more with William Rubenstein, who's the commissioner of the Department of Consumer Protection. We'll be talking about the dispensaries and the producers that are going to be part of this marijuana program, and we're going to be talking with Martha Biebinger from WBUR to find out how this has been going in Massachusetts, some questions about those who are going to be dispensing the legal drug in Massachusetts. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're getting an update on the state's medical marijuana program. It's set to fully roll out later on this summer. We're finding out more from William Rubenstein, who's the commissioner of the Department of Consumer Protection. They oversee the program. We're going to be talking in just a moment about the dispensaries and the producers that have been licensed so far in the state. If you have questions for us, 860-275-7266. We will get to those in just a moment. But first, I want to welcome in Martha Biebinger, who is a healthcare reporter for WBUR. She's been covering this issue in Massachusetts. Martha, good to talk to you once again. Welcome to Where We Live.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. So tell us, first of all, how are things rolling out in Massachusetts right now with their medical marijuana program?
Slowly and with bumps. So back in January, the State Department of Public Health had given what they called provisional approval to 20 dispensaries, but then there was an uproar because it looks like they hadn't really vetted the applications thoroughly. They reviewed those, and then last month pulled out 9 of those. So we're left with 11 dispensaries who can move forward into the process of getting their local inspections and licenses. There are 7 counties, as a result, though, that right now will not have any dispensaries this year and probably not into 2015.
Wow. So, and that, I would assume some people say, provides a little bit of a gap. I mean, Massachusetts is a small state, but it's not that small.
Yes. No, definitely a gap. I mean, the Department of Public Health tried to distribute the licenses that they have awarded the authority to move forward on so that they're it's a dispensary for every 30 miles or so. A patient would be within 30 miles. But as you know, many of the areas of the state aren't covered by public transportation, for example. So driving 30 miles is not an option for everyone, and it certainly isn't convenient.
So what are some of the major problems that officials saw with the licenses, the fact that a number of people were essentially given the green light and then they were given the red light after that? What do they find? What are the problems with these applications?
There were some problems with financing. There were some problems, frankly, with not telling the truth, saying that they had spoken to or had the endorsement of some local public officials who had not signed off on the applications. There were also some problems with criminal records for some of the people who were principals or involved in the dispensaries. Now, some of these people may sue. Some of the nine who were thrown out may sue. They're considering that. And we have some lawsuits pending also on behalf of people who didn't feel like the original scoring was fair at all.
And I'll just actually read one of the other disqualifications here from a report from the Common Health blog that WBUR puts out. Your colleague Lynn Jolliker wrote that among those disqualified is medical marijuana of Massachusetts, the company of former Congressman and Norfolk County District Attorney William Delahunt. DPH faced criticism for originally approving Delahunt's team for three provisional licenses and giving it the highest score out of all applications. Some observers questioned whether Delahunt's political ties contributed to his success. So this is one of these instances, Martha. Any more potential wrongdoing here, at least in terms of appearance of conflict of interest?
Well, we don't know really until we see the final licenses awarded. I mean, we have, this is messy on many levels, John. We have a lawsuit filed by a caregiver who says that the state's requirement that it be a one-to-one ratio, one caregiver for each patient, is not fair or reasonable because there aren't enough caregivers to go around. We have the first lab opening for testing, and the regulations for that are not out yet. You know, this is really a new frontier on many levels, even though laws have been approved in 23 states now. And it feels like when I talk to people that everybody has a sense that they're sort of taking the first step in their territory, whether it's the regulators, the dispensaries, the patients, the doctors. It's a little bit of the Wild West.
It seems like that. A little later on in our program, we will be talking about the actual Wild West, Colorado and Washington State, where things are even a little bit wilder when it comes with marijuana prescriptions, we'll say. Martha Biebinger from WBUR. Hang on for a second, Martha, because I want to put this question about dispensaries and also producers to William Rubenstein here from the Connecticut Department of Consumer Protection. So you've just heard what's happening in Massachusetts. How's it going in Connecticut? Tell us about the, first of all, dispensaries that have been licensed here.
Well, there's six dispensaries that are located throughout the state. We would like to have more. We would like to have more convenient access for our patients, but we don't have a large enough patient base to justify that at the moment. So some patients will have to travel farther than that we would like, but we do have them interspersed throughout the state from both across the southern tier and across the northern tier, east to west. Convenience is a big thing, particularly for patients who have severe debilitating conditions. Travel is not easy for them, and caregivers can't always help them do that. But as the program goes, that'll take care of itself. We do have one advantage in terms of doing these dispensaries, different than a state like Massachusetts, is we have producers and dispensers who are different entities. So producers do all the producing. They can then ship their product to dispensaries statewide rather than have each dispensary grow their own product. It really allows us a lot of flexibility and open new dispensaries.
And Martha, is that one of the issues as far as Massachusetts goes, the fact that the producers are the dispensers?
The regulators here, Mr. Rubenstein, made the point that by having what they call seed to sale, so the whole product occurs under one umbrella in a sense, they felt that that would be an easier system to regulate. Now, I have no idea really whether the pros and cons are one or the other way out, but I don't think that that's necessarily an issue, John, although it will slow the initial rollout because no one can start producing marijuana here for those dispensaries until all of the licenses are sealed.
Just a quick comment on that, Bill.
Well, you know, the just in terms of the seed to sale thing, which is actually a term that's in vogue in a lot of states. You know, oversight is important, and we've decided in Connecticut to oversee this the way we oversee all controlled pharmaceutical substances. We have tight controls over the manufacturers, so we know how they're manufacturing. There's strict inventory requirements. We know to whom they're shipping. There's strict inventory requirements and reporting to the PMP. So the same way that we're able to track other pharmaceutical drugs, we're able to track marijuana products, and the risk of theft and diversion, again, is the same as for those other pharmaceuticals. Now, there's a lot of theft and diversion in other pharmaceutical drugs. I'm not sure that we solve that problem by allowing, you know, dispensers of all the pharmaceutical drugs also manufacture them in-house.
So essentially what you're saying is it's sort of like Pfizer makes a drug, but you don't go to the Pfizer store to pick it up?
That's correct.
Essentially what you're talking about. Martha, before I let you go, what's the next step here? I mean, Bill Rubenstein here in Connecticut is saying by the end of the summer, this program should be up and running. They're going to hit their deadlines. Where does it stand in Massachusetts as far as actually, you know, hitting its targets?
Well, the state won't hit its targets because the law had required the ballot question that people passed left people with the assumption that there were going to be dispensaries open this year. There may be a few, but it will really just be a handful, if there are any at all, by November or December, because there is at least a three-month growing cycle, and none of the dispensaries have cleared all of their local licenses yet. So it may well be into 2015 before we see the first dispensary. You know, we have to figure out who's going to test all of this stuff. There are really many steps ahead before patients can feel like they have a safe, vetted product that they're buying.
That's right. It's not like it's just going to come right off the shelves. It actually has to be grown, right? This takes a little bit of time.
Yes. At least three months. Yep.
Martha Biebinger is a healthcare reporter for WBUR. You can find out more about this story and many others at WBUR.org. And check out their Common Health blog. There's an awful lot of good information about not only this issue, but other healthcare issues in Massachusetts there. Martha, it's always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. We're going to talk about what's happening in New York State in just a little bit. Very quickly, let's go to the production end of things. So how did we choose the producers that we've already licensed here in Connecticut, these four producers that we have right now?
So we had a competitive application process. The request for applications went out in September. Applications were due to us in November. We asked for all sorts of information. We want to know how they were going to do that, their business plan, their marketing plan, their finances, where the money was going to come from, anybody who had a financial interest, who was going to be working in these facilities in terms of management, a whole host of questions that allowed us to evaluate whether or not the producer had the right plan, had the right experience, had the right financial backing. And we had 16 applications ultimately what turned out to be four licenses. So we actually had a very embarrassment of riches in a way to select among.
So four licenses right now, the idea is that the four licenses will align with what you believe the market is right now, the potential for more licenses in the future?
Well, you know, I think the current licensees that we have will meet the current demand and significant increase in demand. They're all large facilities that can start out small on an economically sufficient basis but scale upwards. I think we're not looking at new producers for a couple of years unless demand really takes off.
I'm still fascinated by this idea of how you went around vetting the four producers. Essentially, they were saying, we know how to grow at a fairly large controlled scale a substance that is still federally controlled, that's illegal right now to grow in Connecticut. How does that, you know, work?
Well,
you take my point.
I mean, well, Connecticut is a 19th state, so there's actually fairly robust experience levels in other states, whether it's California, Colorado, or Washington, or Arizona. You know, states for some time have been growing. You know, I will say that there's prior to marijuana become legalized, there was actually a substantial knowledge base built up in the black market. Not that ultimately lent itself to those states that ended up with a legal source. But there are a lot of plant scientists out there, and there are a lot of people who, you know, understand how to grow indoor crops, and then also have had some experience or were able to bring on experience in marijuana in particular. So we didn't have a problem getting, you know, experience levels in any aspect. It was just marrying the people who had the grow experience with people who had the finances, with people who had a business plan that made sense, people who had a marketing plan that made sense. So the whole – and also, you know, we gave points for what kind of community give backs and what kind of compassionate need programs these producers we're going to have, and what kind of employee benefits and environmental benefits. So there are a whole host of things we looked at.
I want to go next to Jesse McKinley, who's a New York Times reporter who's based in Albany. Jesse's been covering New York State's recently passed legislation to legalize medical marijuana. Jesse, welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning.
So maybe you can explain what New York State passed and how you think it's going to be different than the laws in, say, Massachusetts or Connecticut.
Well, I think when the legislature finally passed this and the governor signed it 10 days ago or about a week ago, I think the byword in New York was really control. I mean, there was a lot of caution. There was a lot of fear of kind of failed experiments, at least the way they saw it in New York and California and other places where the drug kind of became more readily available on the street or became available to recreational users. So New York has been incredibly cautious, and the bill that they signed and signed into law a couple weeks ago has like a series of controls that presumably will prevent the drug from getting on the street. Andrew Cuomo made it very clear also in negotiations that the drug would not be allowed to, you would not be able to smoke it in the state of New York, which is different than a lot of other states across the nation. So I think there was really an abundance of caution here about, you know, kind of what they viewed as not success stories in other states.
The idea that the product would not be able to be smoked seems as though it's at least an opening of the door for a black market for medical users to continue. If indeed the traditional way in which the product is consumed isn't legal in the state, then does that really cut down on the black market usage at all?
You know, we'll see. I mean, if you talk to the advocates for medical marijuana, they say that, yes, I mean, the smoking is obviously the optimal way for a lot of people. It allows them to control the dosage. It allows them to control the kind of strength of what they're getting into their bodies. That being said, the New York law does allow for a variety of other methods. You can eat it in a pot brownie. You can put it in a tincture. You can vaporize it like an e-cigarette. And I think the calculation in New York is that if you give enough options to smoking, and presumably those sorts of technologies, you know, whether it be cigarettes or what have you, as those improve, that the necessity for smoking will be less. And I think that the opposition here came directly from the governor, who felt that, you know, smoking in general, whether it be marijuana or tobacco, is simply not good for you.
So we've been talking about Massachusetts and Connecticut, Jesse, and how they have a dispensary system or a dispensary and a production system. How is it slated to look under this new legislation in New York?
It will be limited. I mean, obviously, New York's a much bigger state geographically and population-wise. So, but it will not be a gigantic industry. At first, the law only allows for basically 20 dispensaries to be opened around the state, and those will be operated by five either for-profit or nonprofit institutions. Likewise, the rollout of this looks to be exceedingly slow, at least to the minds of people that have been lobbying for this for, you know, 15, 20 years. The State Department of Health has 18 months to kind of get the regulations in place, to pick out the companies that are going to run the dispensaries. They literally didn't flip the switch, and now there's medical marijuana in the state. It's going to take a while, you know, at least until probably 2016, until any of these dispensaries are actually up and running.
Jesse, hang on for a second. I'm wondering, Commissioner, if you can just comment, if not broadly, on what you think of the direction New York is headed. But, for instance, the fact that the product won't be able to be smoked and patients might not be able to, as Jesse said, control their dosage in the way they might like. How does that play into what's happening here in Connecticut? And does any of this, because Massachusetts has one rule right next door to Connecticut and New York's going to have a new set of rules right next to Connecticut, how much does any of that impact us?
Well, you know, we allow smokable marijuana in Connecticut, but, you know, what we see is a trend. It's happening in other places, although more slowly than we expect it's going to ultimately happen, is that patients really prefer not to smoke, that they're used to smoking, so they smoke that way. Some will always prefer to smoke, but as more product dosage forms come onto the market, as more oils and tinctures and different kinds of edibles or, transdermal patches or a whole, vaporizers come onto the market, we think patients will naturally gravitate to that, and that'll become an increasingly larger part of the market. So, I can't comment on whether New York removing that as an option initially is a good thing. I think ultimately we're all going to get to that world for on the medical side as opposed to the recreational side that the dosage forms will largely not be smokable.
Jesse, a last thing for you. The fact, as I just asked Bill Rubenstein, the fact that neighboring states are all adopting these laws within a few years or months of one another, how much impact has that had on the way New York is viewing this? For instance, the pricing models would probably be similar, at least, or else, again, it seems as though that might lead to some cross-border movement of this product from one state to the next. How has that been looked at by the New York State Legislature?
Well, I'm sure that influenced it. I think, though, the bigger issue here was probably kind of a national, a trend on a national level. I mean, since California legalized in 96, they were very much an outlier at that point. But there really has been kind of a national momentum towards medical marijuana in the last two, three years, but over the last decade, to be sure. And I think that New York kind of saw that coming. And certainly the actions in other states probably influenced it, but I think it was kind of almost, the New York State Assembly had passed this five times. The legislature, the Senate side had been more reluctant, but I think Cuomo in particular saw that, other states were picking it up, that he was kind of right in the middle of the pack kind of in terms of adopting it. So, certainly Massachusetts and Connecticut had something to do with it, but I think it's kind of a broader sense that this is more and more accepted kind of nationwide. So,
and when we come back from our break, we're going to be talking more about that nationwide effort that we've been seeing, especially in Western states. Jesse McKinley is a New York Times reporter based in Albany who's been covering the adoption of medical marijuana laws in that state. Jesse, thanks for joining us on the program. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we come back, we're going to take a bunch of your phone calls because you have questions for William Rubenstein. We'll also be talking with Jacob Sullum, who's a senior editor of Reason Magazine, talking about national drug policy and also what's been happening in Western states. You can join us 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, those who identify as transgender continue to face social stigmas, discrimination, and legal issues that are not often faced by other members of the community at large or even those in the LGBT community. We take a closer look at the current state of transgender rights in the U.S. It's something that Vice President Joe Biden is calling the civil rights issue of our time. I hope you can join us for that conversation tomorrow. On today's program, we're talking about medical marijuana in Connecticut. Elsewhere in the country, states have gone a step further and legalized the drug. Last week in Washington, customers were able to legally purchase marijuana. Here's Jacob Nichols speaking on NPR about why he's buying from the legal dispensaries, which are much more expensive.
Sure, you can buy it for less on the black market right now, but I just want to be able to put the money into the state and the community instead of other people's pockets.
And that's something we're going to be talking about next. We're talking with William Rubenstein, who's Commissioner of the Department of Consumer Protection. I want to bring in Jacob Sullum, who is a senior editor of Reason Magazine. He's a nationally syndicated columnist who writes frequently about drug policy. Jacob, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
I guess the first question I have for you, and we're going to get lots of questions from our listeners, is William Rubenstein off the air was saying there's sort of an East Coast model and a West Coast model of how people are approaching the entire idea of marijuana legalization, whether for medical use or whether for recreational use. Do you see that as a divide, that the West is handling it one way and the East is handling it some other way?
Yeah, I think that the Eastern states tend to be much stricter when they set up their medical marijuana systems. But what's interesting is that in Colorado, the fact that they were relatively loose, that it was pretty easy to get a doctor's recommendation, and a lot of people did, created an industry that has now become the recreational industry. So if you ask, why did Colorado get started relatively quickly compared to Washington, for example. It's because they had an existing medical marijuana industry that was actually regulated by the state, but a lot of people were using it. And you could say a lot of those people were actually recreational consumers in disguise, and that was what a lot of critics said. And, of course, in California, people say the same thing. But the advantage of that is that you actually get to start to sort of see what it is like to have marijuana legal for recreational use. And you start to, you know, create a system where you can do that with these outlets. In California, they're not actually regulated by the state, but in Colorado, they were. So that was sort of a test run for legalization in a way, whereas in states where it's much stricter, like New Jersey, like New York, what the regimes they're setting up are really not at all like, you know, having legalization for general use.
Yeah, the idea of 20 dispensaries in the large state of New York is quite a bit different than 20 dispensaries in maybe one neighborhood in California. Let's go to some phone calls, people who have questions about all this stuff. Eric's from New Haven. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a couple of comments, and I was going to finish off with a question for Mr. Rubenstein.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make a comment about the – I know you guys were talking about the doctor shopping, you know, and so I'm a medical marijuana patient. And even with the list, you know, the 11 lists of syndromes that you have that can qualify you for it, even that was difficult. And I had to do a little bit of doctor shopping for that. And I think one of the reasons why it was so difficult is that, you know, one, there's a lack of just general information and scientific information about the beneficial applications of not only marijuana, but a whole host of family of cannabinoids. And I think a big problem is, you know, there's still this stigma. There's still a stigma with many neurological and psychiatric disorders and how we treat them. And just to kind of give it a little bit of context, you know, it was only about 75 years ago that even in Connecticut we had how we dealt with people with neurological and psychiatric problems. Just the name of the schools we had, like the Connecticut School for Imbeciles and Epileptic Persons.
Sure.
You know, it was only about 50 years ago, you know, that we were still sticking ice picks into people's eyes, you know, for those who had depression and other sorts of neurological and psychiatric disorders.
And Eric, I'm just going to ask you to ask your question of Bill Rubenstein quickly, because we're all running low on time,
sure.
If you don't mind.
So my question for him is, you know, I for one comment, is I kind of disagree with him about the comment he made about, you know, the oils and the edibles, because what both anecdotal evidence and scientific evidence says that one nice thing about the delivery device that is smoking marijuana is the easy ability to both titrate and to administer. But my question is for, you know, adding different conditions, I noticed that you have the board of physicians. Are there going to be any sort of scientists or specialists in the field that will also be on that panel?
The statute sets up, requires that the board be made up of physicians who have a knowledge base in marijuana research, but have very specific board-certified specialties, including, you know, oncologists and neurologists and psychiatrists. But there's no there's no provision in the statute for adding a non-physician scientist to that panel.
I'm wondering, Jacob Sullen, if you could weigh in on one of the other questions we had about this surrounding the various ways to administer the drug. I know that there have been questions in the Western states about edibles getting into the hands of kids, about whether or not Washington State or Colorado has regulated different ways in which you can consume the drug differently. How much of an issue is any of that, given what Eric says and what some of our other callers have asked about?
Well, I mean, I think people need to be educated. They need to understand what the appropriate dosage is. They need to understand the difference between eating marijuana-infused, you know, solid food, which takes quite a while to come on, which is processed by the liver, and therefore has somewhat different psychoactive effects, and either vaporizing or smoking, or using one of these, for example, sublingual tinctures, something like Sativex, which is actually being considered by the FDA. It's a marijuana extract that you put under the tongue. They already have products like that in Colorado that you can put inside your mouth, and so you're absorbing it through the mucous membrane. That's another way to do it, which is faster than eating something, not quite as fast as smoking it. So there's a whole wide range of you know, they mentioned, I think somebody mentioned the patches. That's also a technology that's been developed for marijuana extracts. There's all kinds of ways to administer it, and I think these different routes of administration will appeal to different people. who have different purposes in mind, who have different tastes and preferences, and that's fine. I think there should be a wide range of products and let people choose. On the whole, it's probably better not to smoke it. If you find, for example, that vaporization delivers the medicine that you need and you're able to titrate the dose, which is the case with when you vaporize, you're avoiding a lot of combustion products, and especially if you're a patient and you're consuming it every day, that's probably a good idea to avoid the combustion products.
Well,
but I wouldn't say everybody should be condemned, you know, to swallow something like Marinol, which a lot of patients have rejected because they find it inferior to the whole plant and they find it inferior to either smoking or vaporization.
Jacob just mentioned something, and quickly, if you would, Commissioner, this idea of dosage, even the way in which the drug is being certified in Connecticut and not necessarily prescribed, sort of gets away from the idea that this is something that, you know, if a doctor was prescribing me a dosage of another medicine, I'd actually know how much to take. Where are we with that right now?
So we have a long way to go. We know we have a plant with medicinal qualities. There can be no doubt about that. Making it into medicine, that is, where a physician can say, take X number of milligrams of whatever it is three times a day for your condition, we're far away from that. What we have is, right now, is developing the data to do it from that. We're developing that data through observational data collection, and that will lead to hypothesis and ultimately to scientific experimentation. So we're gonna get there. What's critical to doing that, of course, is knowing what's in the medicine that people are taking. So that's why in Connecticut we require laboratory testing that creates a product profile of all active ingredients, including the terpenes that are in the product, and then we can then begin to collect data that associates condition and efficacy with dosage.
Alex is in Woodbridge. Go ahead quickly, if you would, Alex.
My question for the commissioner is, what privacy protections are in place for the patient database? Some people, particularly of a certain generation, might be concerned about being identified as registered marijuana users.
So the database by statute is both confidential and not subject to the Freedom of Information Act. So patient data is not available except for very limited purposes. There's some research that would allow aggregated data to be disclosed, but individual patient data is confidential except in limited circumstances. There is an exception for law enforcement efforts that have a specific investigation. There's no phishing into our database. Law enforcement can't peek into our database in that way.
But it's not strictly the same as the doctor-patient confidentiality. You wouldn't be able to find out what my doctor is prescribing me in a normal basis with a prescription.
It's very, very, very much like the very same kind of HIPAA protections that you're going to have. But it's not under HIPAA for a lot of reasons. But it's that level of confidentiality. Yes,
Nakia, I would like to get a very quick question from you.
Hi.
Go ahead. Yep.
Thank you. So I'm a psychologist, and I was just listening to this discussion, and just had some concerns about people diagnosed with sort of more less concrete disorders, like post-traumatic stress disorder. In my line of work, I work with young adults, and often we see that, you know, there's a lot of comorbid disorders that go on, and there are risks for things like psychotic disorder or really severe anxiety, paranoia.
And I'm going to leave it there because I want to get a quick answer from the commissioner. Thank you.
Yeah, so you know, physicians have to be cognizant of the research out there in terms of both beneficial effects, but also importantly adverse effects. And there's a lot of research that have to do with adverse effects that physicians can take advantage of.
I'm sure that we will have William Rubenstein back to talk about this more. William Rubenstein is the commissioner of the Department of Consumer Protection. Thank you so much for your time. I also want to thank Jacob Sullum, who is the senior editor for Reason Magazine, for joining us. Thanks to Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown, who produce our program. Happy birthday, Lydia. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.